Let's get rolling on the new business lunch now. This is John Williams. Elise Glink is our Monday guest. We'll talk to her until the bottom of the hour about real estate, about some other economic news, some postscripts from the last half hour of the show, too. Stay right there. Okay, Elise Glink, it's your turn. How are you today?
Oh, very much here with the living and very sad that somebody would miss another Christmas. It's kind of a festive week, right, John?
Particularly since for a lot of us, he's the voice of our favorite Christmas song right now about driving home for Christmas. Okay, so it's the year end. What economic charts and graphs are you looking at?
You know, it's really interesting. The Aspen Institute, which is sort of well-known, based in Colorado, they every year release the Aspen Economic Strategy Group's kind of best charts of the year. And usually I come on your show and I have sort of not great news, and because this has been just a year, right? I'm sure everybody's ready to get this year in the rearview mirror.
Yeah.
But when you look at some of their charts, it was kind of encouraging, I thought. And I thought it might be nice to share some nice news with everybody for a change. If you look over one of their charts and papers this year that they published, wage growth by income decile, so the people, how it's looked from, say, 1973 to 2023, which is kind of the last year that they had the complete data set that they looked at, and it was under the staff report of current evidence of household financial well-being. And what they discovered at the Aspen Institute is that wage growth, while not uniform across time or everything else, the story over the last 50 years has been that most Americans have seen substantial wage growth. It may not be enough to make you feel better about going to the store and buying eggs, milk, butter, and cheese, let alone beef, but we have done pretty well. Of course, the people who have done really well, top 10%, of course, but others in the whole society, and again, it hasn't been evenly spread, but overall, over 50 years, we're still all doing better than we were back then. And that, I think, is good news.
Yeah, I think it's easy to forget that. We get so caught up in how we're doing month over month or year over year in general. It's sort of like inflation. They say, well, it's 2.4%, and is that a good number or a bad number? That's more expensive than it was last year, but it's not unexpected that prices would go up a little bit. So what's a reasonable pain point for people to tolerate, right?
Right. No, I think that's a really good point. And when you look at inflation and the new numbers that came out, I think everybody's got a lot of questions about it because of the shutdown. But
yeah.
We are, you know, generally heading in the right direction. The Federal Reserve would like to see inflation at about 2% where it was. That means your income grows hopefully a little bit above that, and wage, you know, your price of groceries grows maybe a little bit below that. But overall, you know, you're keeping pace as we're going along. And that's kind of a good thing. And what's been out of sync for the last 5 years since the COVID pandemic has been this massive spike in inflation, which all of us are still feeling because, of course, prices never go down.
Massive spike of inflation.
Up.
What are you talking about? What number? You mean when it hit 9% during the pandemic?
Yeah. Yes. And even as it came down to 6% and 5% and 3%, you know, it's still higher than it was. And of course, some of the things that we really care most about, like, say, the cost of rent or the cost, your mortgage, those are still, you know, higher than they were, and we still have muscle memory thinking, well, my mortgage should be 2.5%, and when it's 6%, that's a shock.
I was thinking the other day when I heard that while that is maybe going in the right direction, unemployment is going up, and maybe that's the more important number, because 2% or 3% or 4% of inflation, you'll feel that, but you'll feel it 100% if you don't have a job. It would seem to me like unemployment is maybe the most critical thing for us to pay attention to. Do you agree with that?
I absolutely do. And it is going up. And the I haven't talked about the U6 in years, basically since the Great Recession. The U6 is the broadest measure of unemployment, and it has hit 8.5%, which is, or even a little bit higher than that. That means that 8.5% of Americans are either unemployed or working part-time jobs when they'd rather be doing full-time jobs, or they're kind of contract and not secure in their jobs and feel like they're about to lose their jobs. So 8.5% is the true measure, the complete measure of unemployment right now.
What else are you looking at in these charts and these numbers, Elise?
Well, the Aspen Institute, once a year, they come back and they send out some of their more popular or more important to their mind charts and graphs and things that they've done. And so another one that I thought that caught my eye, really, John, and I know you'll appreciate this, is how much poverty has fallen since the 1980s. And by roughly half is how much it's fallen, according to income-based measures, and by more than 80% if you use consumption-based. And so what that really means to me is that, again, as we're feeling, you know, maybe like we're just not keeping up, if you take a broader view and you take a look at where we were with income-based poverty, for example, it was like 13% back in 1980 of the population, and now income-based poverty is listed at about 6.1%. Again, this isn't how you feel. This is just sort of official looking, you know, how it all looks. And, you know, that's a really wonderful thing. It means we're able to buy more. We're still able to keep up in a lot of ways. I know it doesn't feel that good, and there are some charts that do speak to that. And so one of those is that nearly 50% of renters in
the
U.S.
That's the one I'm looking at now. I'm sorry,
right,
go ahead.
Are paying more than 30% of their income towards rent.
And say that again, Elise.
Sure. Nearly half of all renters in the U.S. pay more than 30% of their income toward their rent. Very high rent burden.
And if you're renting, you probably are not a high wage earner. And so you're probably dealing with, you know, limited income to some degree or another. You're renting. And now a third of your income, I wonder if that's gross or net, goes to rent alone. Says here they find that from 1980 to 23, median inflation-adjusted rent, median inflation-adjusted rent has nearly doubled, while the share of renters who are rent burden spending over 30% has risen from 35 to 48%. Wow.
So that is typically calculated on your gross income. Just like when you get a mortgage, they look at your gross income, not your net income. And that makes it feel even higher when you look on the take-home pay, right?
Yeah.
So it's that, I think, is one of the biggest reasons that people are feeling really strapped right now. And when you look at some of the concerns that economists had about the numbers, a lot of it had to do with the rent. And it literally was reported at zero. So, of course, inflation was going to look like it was lower if you're not even counting, you know, what people are spending on their rent. So there was a whole lot of controversy last week about those numbers. And, I have to say, this is a huge burden. Rent and mortgage typically are the biggest expenses you're going to pay in your budget. And so when it's this much of your take-home pay and this much of your gross income, it really hurts.
One last quick comment from you, from a listener. It is unrealistic for people to believe that 2 or 3% mortgage rates is where they should be. Those rates were a result of severe economic trauma. It was the emergency treatment put in place by the Federal Reserve. We need to get realistic as to what to expect in interest rates. What do you think of that?
Absolutely true. The only other time we saw interest rates drop, and it didn't even go this low, was during the Great Recession. And I'm just going to say in modern memory, right? But the problem is that we're not far enough away from that. People are still remembering it. Mm. And believe it or not, half of all mortgages are still at 4% or below in this country. And so people are just not giving them up. They don't want to pay anymore. And so everybody else is like, oh, why do I have to pay 6%? And that's, to your listener's point, John, is the problem. We just aren't getting realistic about where interest rates are probably going to be.
For guidance and insight, click on thinkglink.com, thinkglink.com. That's where we find Elise Glink. Thank you, Elise.
Thank you, and Merry Christmas to you and everybody else.
Jim Dahlke joins us now on the Noon Business Lunch, the Director of Communications at TechNexus Venture Collaborative. TechNexus.com is their website. Thanks for joining us, Jim. How are you today?
Hey, John. Doing great. Thanks for having me.
All right. Let's start by talking about a Northwestern biotech spin-out. What's the story here?
Yeah, some new funding for a Chicago biotech startup. The company is called Amphix Bio. This is a spin-out out of Northwestern University. And, just raised $12.5 million in new funding really interesting biotech company. They've created a special material to help the human body heal from severe injuries, specifically spinal cord injuries and some spinal fusion, so chronic back pain. Really kind of fascinating business here. They've developed a drug that is injected into the spinal cord and encourages the neurons to grow back and reconnect, potentially restoring movement. So this is regenerative medicine here from this local Chicago startup. And you know, what's so interesting too about this is that, you know, most current treatments for these types of injuries, be it to the spine or the back, it's really kind of just managing pain and or using mechanical fixes like metal rods. And what Amphix Bio is doing is it's different because it's actually aiming to regenerate the tissue, effectively reversing the injury rather than just patching it up. So a new round of funding for these guys as they look to head to new human clinical trials.
You know, when you talk about these kinds of stories, I always want them to happen faster. I mean, you want this company to be successful, and if they are successful, if that's a good investment, then good Lord, who knows what they're onto there? Or, you know, maybe it won't regrow nerves. Maybe people who can't walk won't be able to walk again. But whatever they're up to, you almost become impatient listening to the promise in your story, you know?
Yeah, and you know, and that's really kind of the key bridge of all this is kind of bringing that technology out of the university system and commercializing it. And then so that's, you know, when a lot of companies are turning to sort of the early stage of funding, it's really a key piece of the puzzle because, you know, you want the innovations to accelerate outside of the lab. You want it to move beyond kind of the university system and into the market. And, you know, venture funding and angel funding plays a big role in that because, you know, it's not cheap to work on these types of innovations, especially in the healthcare and medicine field. And so, you know, that's a role that, you know, the capital at the venture capital level really is an important piece.
And I wonder, is the federal government putting money into these sorts of things anymore? A lot of this that happens at the university, I suppose, is in some jeopardy for now because the administration has rolled back a bunch of grants until they work out settlements with these schools. I just wonder how much we as a government or as a country are pumping into this sort of research.
Yeah, it's definitely a different game today than it has been in the past. However, the government is definitely still funding these types of endeavors. And in total, Amphix Bio has raised about $18 million, and some of that non-dilutive as well. So they've taken funding that in the form of grants and other things outside of traditional venture funding. So the money is still out there. But yes, it's certainly maybe not quite as cut and dry as it has been in the years past.
$18 million doesn't sound like enough. Okay. Talk about Rivian. What are they up to these days?
Yeah, just the other week, they had held a really, you know, kind of fascinating AI and autonomy day for the company, effectively, you know, really sort of planting their flag in autonomous vehicles. They actually are going to create their own artificial intelligence chip, replacing the ones they you know, could use from NVIDIA, for example, which is really fascinating, right? Because NVIDIA is, you know, kind of thought of as this giant technology maker really powering the AI revolution. They are going to be the ones providing AI chips to all the companies that want to do AI. And some companies like Rivian, which makes its trucks in downstate Normal, actually has decided that they're going to go out on their own and make their own AI chips. And so, you know, Rivian is building towards a future where, you know, it believes that it's going to be able to create, you know, fleets of autonomous Rivian vehicles that can potentially create as a rideshare service in addition to just having your own vehicle that is autonomous. You know, this is a business too, right, that's got to kind of show investors that it's, you know, got areas for growth amid, you know, a moment right now where the EV industry is seeing a bit of a pullback and a slowdown as the subsidies went away in September. And so all of these issues are certainly facing Rivian as it, you know, kind of plays second fiddle to Tesla at the current moment. But what the company believes is that, you know, it's got the AI chops to really compete, not just with Tesla, but to potentially be, you know, a major player even in the ride-sharing space.
Speaking of chips, the Daily podcast today told the story of TSMC, the Taiwan-based company which is building a chip manufacturing plant north of Phoenix in the desert. And it's a fascinating story about what they say is the largest manufacturing plant in the country ever. It's this mammoth, sprawling place where they're going to try and make the high-end chips that the world needs, that the United States needs. They're running into some headwinds in that when you do business in the United States and you're going to dig a hole, there's 18 different agencies that you have to get approval of. And it's a very slow, arduous process, but it's a hundreds of billions of dollar investment into the state of Arizona to make these chips. And something like a third of the chips that are made in the world will now be made in the Phoenix area. Good news, if they can just ever get that thing up and running, they're still building the plant.
Yeah, and that's not going to be the last, right? We are going to be having a lot more facilities like this in Phoenix and elsewhere, whether it's plants for chips, whether it's data centers to power all of the energy, right, and all of the artificial intelligence. None of this is slowing down anytime soon. And so, really 2025, I think, is going to kind of capstone this movement to really solidify that AI is here and that the infrastructure is going at a rapid pace all around it.
One more talk about this op-ed piece. U.S. quantum future depends on regions like Chicago. That's a nice piece, isn't it?
Yeah, the Cranes ran an op-ed really kind of talking about the quantum future in Chicago and really the regional approach that the city and the area has taken to the growth here is really interesting. It's not just the quantum park on the south side, which of course broke ground this year and has been landing anchor tenants. There's activity happening, kind of throughout the region, throughout the Big Ten region. Purdue, for example, has a lot of research and momentum in the quantum space as well, as they have their own programs which connect into what's happening here in Chicago. And so, folks on the ground really believe that that's the strength of the city, right? It's not that Chicago is going at this alone and is going to be sort of the kingmaker of quantum, that it's really a collaborative approach. Across the region and across institutions, we're seeing, activity at the national lab space, whether it's Fermilab or Argonne. There's quite a bit of quantum activity, momentum, and research being taking place right there. Universities from UChicago to Northwestern and the corporate companies, right? IBM being, a main tenant in the quantum campus on the south side. And so it's really kind of that ecosystem approach to collaboration that's helping Chicago get a head start in the quantum space.
Jim Dahlke, Director of Communications at TechNexus Venture Collaborative. Okay, well done, Jim. Thanks for your help.
Thanks, Sean.
Ari Kravopisk is on a phone line, the CEO at The Yard. Let's talk a little bit about sort of flexible workspaces these days. Ari, you're on WGN's Noon Business Lunch. How are you?
How are you, John? It's a pleasure to be here.
So talk to me about The Yard Signature. What is your business? What do you all do?
So basically, we are a high-end co-working space located on the west side of the Fulton Market on 1101 Westlake. We are a company that started roughly like 10 to 12 years ago in New York and expanded to different cities. And we're very proud to have opened our new location here in Chicago.
So while downtown occupancy rates are low, the need for flexible workspace, maybe because people just aren't going to pay those long-term rents anymore, the demand for what you all do is high, and you are kind of in the luxury end of that. Talk about your niche in that market. What do you all provide?
Yeah, that's exactly as you said. There's still a lot of demand for flexible space. People is looking for that type of flexibility, that you can get a space with no big guarantees, a space that is turnkey, ready. You just need to bring your laptop, your team, and start working. And in this location, we do provide different differential service. Our location, for example, has showers. We have yoga classes. We include snacks and breakfast for the teams. We also have concierge services in case you need to make a reservation or order something. Our team is there to help. So our idea is to provide this higher end or more exclusive service on the co-working world and be able to satisfy the needs of the new worker generation.
So the clients, are they single individuals? Is it a small group of 10 or 15 people? How many people gather in any of these spaces?
So it's a very interesting question. Actually, we do have like everything. So we do have like startups and wellness for like one or two people, two companies that have like 75 locations with us. So certainly I believe that today, not only the small startup or the new company is looking for flex space, but big old corporate clients as well are looking to this type of space that provides them flexibility. As you know, today with AI, teams grow and shrink from one a semester to the other. So for companies to have that flexibility is very, very important. And we cater like all those different type of companies, like from a single person company to like 100 per company person.
I wonder too if some people use it just as needed. Like maybe I'm renting that space for the month, but I don't even need it this week. But then I'm having a meeting either with clients or my team, and now I need a professional space. Is that how people use it as well?
People use it as like that. So something that is interesting is sometimes you have teams that, let's say a team of like 10, but usually the 8 people use the space, and then they rotate within themselves to use the space. At the same time, as you said, you can basically just get a month or like a year and be able to use the space as you need it. Also, we have also other alternatives that if you need like a conference room, a podcast studio, a meeting room, or do an event, you can certainly call us and have that alternative to do it with us.
When I have a space with you guys, do I have a set space, or is it first come, first serve every day? It's just maybe pods and you just find some space. How defined is this space if I'm using you?
So we have different alternatives. So we have the private office, and those private offices, if one is yours, that's the one that is yours, and nobody's getting in there. Then we have other solutions like the common areas, and those areas is as first comes, first serve, and it's basically like an open, beautiful living room that everybody can sit in a communal table or like in a private space, and they can use it by themselves. But the office suite that is you typically like live for like a month or more, mm-hmm. Those spaces are private, and you can basically, you share common spaces with everybody else, but the private space is only yours.
You said you're at 1101 West Lake over in Fulton Market, which is not a surprise. That's a logical place, I think, for you to be. What is the service that people like the most? Is it the food? I think a lot of times places offer services that people think sound good, but then they don't use them. What do people appreciate the most, would you say?
So I would say that Fulton Market has this young vibe, the amount of like F&B solutions that are in the area. It has like a great access to public transportation as well. It's a very nice place to walk, to go at the end of the day, have like a beer with friends, a drink, go to a good restaurant. So I think like Fulton has basically captivated the attention of like a lot of like people, and that's why the neighborhood has developed so much. And as we see, like in the last couple of years, more and more alternatives have been coming to Fulton Market, and that's just a reaction of like the demand of the people going in there. So yes, I think I agree with you. I think the Fulton Market is certainly a very attractive destination, and we see a lot of people coming and going to that space more and more.
TheYard.com is the website, TheYard.com. Ari Krivopisk is the CEO. Ari, thanks for giving us a heads up on that. Good to know. I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much, John. It was a pleasure.